This past week, we all remember, and you know, it's very recent, in our very recent memory, there was a tragic shooting up in Connecticut, and a deranged young man took and decided that he was going to get back at his mother, apparently, and go out and kill a few people, and he killed 20 children and six brave adults who tried to save some of those children. It wasn't and certainly a tragic event, but as it is with almost all tragic events, there's always a good side of it. And how do we see a good side in something like this? Well, it's hard to see oftentimes. But the thing that we did see is a big outgrowth of church-going people that Sunday. The churches were filled on Sunday as a result of that. And, of course, the churches will probably be filled again tomorrow. Because when tragedy happens like that, people get serious about life and they get serious about God. And unfortunately, that's sometimes the only time they get serious about God is during a tragedy. Other catastrophic events like such as Hurricane Katrina, if you remember that, after that, many people found God. And then, of course, the attack on the World Trade Center, many people found God after that. And as a result, the country became united to some degree. And like I said again, churches, synagogues were filled. Generally, synagogues are only filled on Yom Kippur. But during and shortly after the time of the World Trade Center, because many people looked at that as an Islamic attack on Israel, the synagogues themselves were filled as well. But do people really need to suffer in order to turn to God? Do we have to have catastrophe before the people of God will come together and turn to God even for a short period of time? Well, in this teaching, I want to discuss a prophetic event that involves the family of God, those of us who consider ourselves to be God's children. And we're going to go through this event. It's a New Testament event, and it's actually touched on a little bit this morning. And we're going to see how that parallels our day today. But there, before I get to that, though, there is an event in biblical history that pretty much parallels what we're seeing today, and something that's happening today. As John mentioned a little bit earlier, we're in the midst of a spiritual awakening. God is waking people up, and they're beginning to see things that they had never seen before. I met a young couple this morning who are somewhat new to this walk. And I'm sure you people do too. You see people all the time who are finding people who are just coming into this walk. Well, there is a spiritual awakening taking place, and it's important that we know about it and we understand it. But this event that I'm talking about that's in the New Testament we're going to be looking at, it wasn't handled correctly in its day. And I believe as a result, catastrophe was brought upon the people of God. And I think that if we can get the message from what happened earlier and learn from the lessons of history, we might be able to avert a catastrophe that was probably going to be the worst catastrophe since Noah's flood. But the event that we're getting ready to, that we're seeing right now, the things that we're seeing right now, is something that, according to the Jews, is called the regathering of the exiles. How many of you ever heard that term, the regathering of the exiles? Or how about the return of the lost sheep of the house of Israel? Okay, a little bit more familiar term, the lost sheep of the house of Israel. The return of God's people, the regathering of the exiles, is actually the restoration of one of the largest families, or probably I would say the largest family ever to exist. And it's happening in our day if we can simply open our eyes and see what's going on. So I want to give you a little quick history lesson. This is a history of Israel. The history of Israel in 2 minutes. Here we go. As you know, Israel was a kingdom that was ruled by King David first, and then by his son, King Solomon. But King Solomon, as we know, turned against God and mixed the worship of God with the pagan worship of the hundreds of wives that he had. And so God tore the kingdom from King Solomon and divided it up in half. Divided it in half, gave part of it to Jeroboam, and the other part to Solomon's son Rehoboam. Jeroboam's kingdom, the northern kingdom of Israel, and this is a term I want you to remember, the northern kingdom of Israel, became known as Ephraim. And Ephraim also became known as Israel. And so the people of Israel in the period of the prophets was not necessarily the Jews. It was the people from the northern kingdom. And then on the southern kingdom of Israel, which was continued to be ruled by King Rehoboam, was known as Judah, or the kingdom of Judah, or the house of Judah. And so that's important for us to know, because the prophecies in the Old Testament refer to these two different peoples, the house of Judah and the house of Israel. And if we get them confused, we generally miss the whole crux of what the prophets were saying. Now, Israel, the northern kingdom, was driven out of the land of Israel in around 700 BC. And then about 200 years later, the southern kingdom of Judah was taken into Babylonian captivity by King Nebuchadnezzar. And of course, they eventually returned, the Jews eventually returned to the land, at least some of them, and rebuilt the temple and set the stage for the coming of Messiah. But prophecies show that the return of the Jews in the 3rd century BC was not the culmination of God's plan as far as regathering is concerned. Because though they were exiles, the greater majority of the exiles, the northern tribes, were still in exile. They were still gone. They were still scattered out. And so that was not the fulfillment. The return of the Jews to Babylon, or from Babylon, was not the fulfillment of the regathering of the exiles. But there are a number of scriptures in the Tanakh, or in the Old Testament. The Tanakh is a acronym for the Old Testament. There's a number of prophecies in the Old Testament that I'd like to go through real quickly that shows how important the return of the exiles is to God. And so we're going to go through some things real quickly, some scriptures real quickly. You might want to write them down if you want to turn to them. First one, Deuteronomy 30, verse 3. And this is where Moses is talking to the children of Israel shortly before he dies. And in Deuteronomy 30, verse 3, Moses says, "Then Yahweh your God will restore your fortunes and have compassion on you, and he will gather you again from all the peoples where Yahweh your God has scattered you." So Moses here talks about the scattering of Israel and the regathering of Israel, all in one verse. Isaiah 11, verse 12. I'm going to read this out of the English Standard Version because it sort of makes it a little bit easier to read, I guess you might say. Isaiah 11, verse 12. "He will raise a signal for the nations and will assemble the banished of Israel and gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." So here in Isaiah, we're seeing God specifically saying he's going to gather the banished of Israel and the dispersed of Judah. Two groups back together. He's going to begin to gather them together. Isaiah 43, verse 5. "Fear not, for I am with you. I will bring your descendants from the east and gather you from the west." So God is going to go out and gather all the nations, all of his people from all the nations in which they were scattered. And there again in Isaiah 56, verse 8, "Yahweh, your God, who gathers the outcast of Israel, declares, I will gather yet others to him besides those who are already gathered." And so he's saying that after God has gathered his people Israel back to himself, then he's going to begin to gather non-Israelites, the Gentiles, the true Gentiles, with them. And then the last one is Jeremiah 29, verse 14. Jeremiah 29, 14. "I will be found by you, says Yahweh, and I will bring you back from your captivity. I will gather you from the nations and from all the places where I have driven you, says Yahweh. I will bring you to the place from which I cause you to be carried away captive." In other words, they were driven out of Israel, and when they're drawn back, they're going to be drawn back to Israel. They're going to be drawn back to the same place from which they were driven. And I would submit that they would be drawn back to the same geographic area of Israel from which they were scattered. So for those of us who believe we may be a son of Gad, then we'll probably be going back to the area of Gad. Or if we're a Benjaminite, as Paul was, then we would be brought back to the area of Benjamin, which is now in Palestinian hands. So we have a little bit of vested interest into wanting to get the people who don't belong there out of there, because you might say that's our land. But that's not what I want to talk about. But Israel was dismantled piece by piece, little by little, because the northern tribes weren't driven out all at once. They were driven out systematically. The Assyrians came in at different times and took some of the Israelites out. And the same thing with Judah. Judah was originally driven out in stages out of Israel when they went into Babylon. And when the Jews were driven out after the death of the Messiah, they were again driven out little by little. They didn't all go out at one time. So we could assume that if God's going to gather what he has driven out, he will gather them the same way he's driven them out, and gather them little by little by little. And I believe that is exactly what we're seeing today. We're going to look at this earlier partial fulfillment of the prophecies of return, the ones we just talked about, to see how God's people dealt with those who are returning in their day. But before we do, I want to consider the ramifications if we don't get it right. Like I said before, I don't think in the first century they got it right, in the example I'm getting ready to tell you. But I think that we have the opportunity to do so. Because if we don't get it right, it's not going to be good for us. And I'll tell you why. I want to go through an explanation of a verse that was actually part of the announcement about this gathering this weekend. And that is the Malachi prophecy of the return of the hearts of the fathers to the children and the children to their fathers. But to set this up, we need to go back 3,500 years to the prophet Moses when he was standing before Yahweh at the burning bush. We actually sang a song just a few minutes ago that related to that episode. Moses was sent by God to Egypt to begin the gathering of the Israelites and bring them into the promised land. But, you know, he didn't really think he was up to the task. He had shortcomings that he did not think qualified him to do this job. And not only that, he didn't believe that the Jewish or the Israelite leaders in Egypt at that time would actually believe that Moses was the promised Messiah that they had been looking for. And so Moses asked Yahweh to tell him what name he should say, told him to go out and connect and gather the Israelites. Under what name have I been sent? Under what name are you sending me to go and gather the Israelites out of Egypt? And God said, "Thus you shall say," and this is in Exodus 3, verse 15, "Thus you shall say to the children of Israel, Yahweh, God of your fathers, Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial to all generations." So if you go back to Exodus 3:15 and look at those scriptures, we have some identifying points right here. Number one, we understand who the fathers are. The fathers are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And the children are us. We are the children. Now, Abraham was a man who made a number of good choices, but he made a number of bad choices before he made good choices oftentimes. But nevertheless, Abraham was called a friend of God. Well, why is it that Abraham, a man who messed up a lot, but then turned around and did the right thing later on, why was he called a friend of God? What made Abraham God's friend? Well, I can give you one good example of why he would be considered God's friend. And of course, James is the one who told us that Abraham was God's friend. If you were to turn to Genesis 18, verses 17 through 19, This is the story where the three men came up to Abraham, and they were on their way to take care of Sodom and Gomorrah. And it says in the text here, "And Yahweh said, shall I hide from Abraham what I am doing? For I have known him in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of Yahweh to do righteousness and justice, that Yahweh may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him." So what made Abraham special to God was that Abraham would raise up his children in a walk that was a godly walk in the ways of God. In fact, the scripture goes on to show that Abraham actually had the Torah. He knew the commandments of God. He knew the mitzvot. He knew it all according to what the scripture says. So Abraham is an important person. So now we know that we are the children of God, and we also know that our fathers are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And so now let's go to the book of Malachi, the one that was quoted earlier in the flyer that John sent out. Malachi is an end-time prophecy that I believe pertains to us, the children of God, the descendants of Abraham. And in this prophecy, the end-time Elijah is to turn, and this is Malachi 4, verse 6, turn the hearts of fathers to their children and the hearts of children to their fathers. In other words, there's going to be a unification here. The family is going to become closer together because they're going to be turning their hearts to the fathers and the fathers to the children. But there again, who are the fathers and who are the sons? Because the word in this passage in Malachi for sons is the word bane, and it actually means sons, not necessarily children. But I submit that the fathers are again Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the sons are us, the children of Israel. And if that's the case, I believe that a better rendering of this passage would be, he will return the hearts of the fathers to the children, the hearts of the children to the fathers. It's not that he will turn the hearts, he will return the hearts. Because the Hebrew word here for turn is shuv, and shuv actually means return. So I believe God is saying that he's going to return the hearts of the fathers to the children. Now, does that mean that the fathers are all of a sudden going to be starting to love their children? I don't believe that's the case. I believe what God is saying here is that the children now are going to take on the hearts of the fathers. The children now are going to start to long for what Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob longed for. And what was it that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob looked forward to that they never actually received in their lifetime? And that what that is, I'll just tell you right out, what it is the promise of their children being a multitude of peoples and of them inheriting a land. So the purpose for all this is to have a place for a regathering, a reuniting of the people. So, why is this Malachi passage important? Because at the end of the Malachi passage, I didn't quote it all, at the end of the Malachi's passage says that if Elijah does not come and turn the hearts of the children to the fathers and the hearts of the fathers to the children, it then says, I will come and strike the land with utter destruction. So it's important that the hearts of the fathers are turned to the children, and the hearts of the children are turned to the fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And it's also important that we understand what it's all about. Well, I believe that if we act now to return to the ways of Yahweh, as illustrated by the fathers, maybe we can avert the destruction that's poised to envelop our land. Well, you might say, well, that can never happen because the prophecies are there. The prophecies are set. There's no way that the upcoming destruction could not come upon us. It's been prophesied. Prophecy never fails. But I can think of a prophecy that did fail. I bet Jonah can think of a prophecy that failed. And that was the prophecy of Jonah and the land of Nineveh. Because God told Jonah to go and say in 3 days, Nineveh is going to be destroyed. But in 3 days, what happened? Nineveh repented. They turned to God. And at least for a period of time, they were spared. And the destruction that was foretold to come upon them didn't take place. So I don't believe the story of Jonah was just put in the Bible to fill space. I think it was there for a purpose. And I think it's a message to us that if we do as a people turn back to God, then God certainly can and will spare us. Well, maybe it will, maybe it won't. I don't know. You know, it's hard to know. We've always got to walk as if destruction is coming and pray for the best, right? So we just keep walking forward. If we're part of those whose hearts are being turned, if we're part of the exiles, then let's talk a little bit about how we should deal with others who are turning to the walk, and how should we react to others who are turning to the walk as well. Because we have a problem in this walk right now, and I'll address that a little bit later. I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. In regards to the gathering of the exiles, the Jewish people pray a particular prayer 2 and sometimes 3 times a day. That prayer is called the Shemoneh Esrei, which means 18 benedictions. It's more widely known as the Amidah, or the standing prayers. And the 10th prayer of the Amidah is a prayer that's called Kibbutz Galyot. Kibbutz Galyot. And it means regather the exiles. And it goes like this. Sound the great shofar for our freedom and raise the ensign to gather our exiles and gather us from the four corners of the earth. Blessed are you, O Yahweh, who gathers the dispersed of his people Israel. So the Jewish people are praying 2 and 3 times a day for the regathering of the exiles, the gathering of us back to the land, gathering of us to the walk of God. They're praying for it 2 to 3 times a day. If our brother Judah is praying for the gathering of the exiles, should we not be praying for the gathering of the exiles as well? Or do we even consider the gathering of the exiles? Do we ever consider how important it is that the Jewish people are taught Messiah and that the Jewish people come to the walk? I would submit that in many cases we are not. Are we as interested about the largest gathering to take place in world history, are we interested enough to pray about it on a daily basis? Well, the Jewish people do every day. Part of the reason that we as I'm going to say Gentiles, though I don't believe we're Gentiles, part of the reason why we as Gentiles don't believe or are not praying for the gathering of the exiles is because we have an identity problem. We don't know who we are. We don't know who our brothers are. And because we don't know how to deal with them. We believe we're Gentiles. And for most of us, there was a period of time when we were Gentiles. Because in the first century, what was the definition of a Gentile? It was a pork-eating, Sunday-keeping, pagan God-worshipping person, right? You know, you could be a Jew and be a Gentile at the same time? Because if you were a pork-eating, what are those things I said? You'd be considered a Gentile by the Jews, even though you were a Jew yourself. And so when our fathers came and began to come back into the land back 2,000 years ago, our brothers and sisters, when they began to come back, they came back as Gentiles because that's what they were doing. So we have an identity problem. We were at least at one time people who believed that we could eat these things. We could worship a tree. We could take and We would consider God's law to be a strange thing, as it says in the book of Hosea. Yes, we have a real identity problem, and we need to try to help work that out. Well, the Bible teaches about a family that also had an identity problem. They couldn't identify one of their brothers. And this is a story that's actually in this week's parasha. The parasha is the weekly prescribed readings that are done in a Jewish synagogue. All through the year, they go through a certain number of readings, and they're all portions of the five books of Moses called the Torah. And it just so happens that this week's parasha is about Joseph revealing himself to his brothers. If you remember the story of Joseph, and I sure hope we do, because it's the story I love the most. Every year when we go through this, this is the one I tell all the people in our congregation, oh, I just love this. And they say, yeah, I know you do. Because Joseph is a very important person. Joseph was the first savior of Israel, if you really think about it. But Joseph was second in command in Egypt. His brothers came to Egypt to buy grain during a famine, but they didn't recognize that the person that they were trying to buy grain from was their brother who they had thrown into a pit just 13 years earlier. Why didn't they recognize Joseph? Well, I'll give you a couple of reasons why. Number one, he had taken on a non-Israelite name. The second thing was that he was dressed as an Egyptian. And he probably spoke as an Egyptian. But as the story goes, Joseph became the savior of Israel because he was the one who God had inspired to take and gather the food together and have it available when the famine came. So there's two stories. There's many, many lessons in the story of Joseph, but there's two particular lessons that I think are most important for us to realize as we begin to look at the people that God is drawing back into the walk of God. Number one is that those persons may not look like we think they should look. They may not be dressed the way we think they should be dressed. They may wear funny hats, or they may have curlicues running down the sides of their face. But nevertheless, they could be God's people. And another lesson that we should learn from the story of Joseph is that our reaction to our newfound brothers must be based on God's plan, not on our feelings toward our brothers. And if you remember, Joseph, instead of getting mad when he finally revealed himself to his brothers, and instead of him trampling on them for what they had done to him, he said, this was God's will that I was thrown into that pit and that I ended up where I'm at. And it was for your protection and for your life that I was put here. We today have an identity problem. We don't understand who we are. We've been taught that we're the church. We've been taught that the church has replaced Israel. And in much of our vernacular, that means that we've replaced the Jews. We didn't understand, and maybe we still don't understand, that we're Israelites too, even though we're not Jewish. Because you can be Jewish and not be an Israelite. I'm sorry, you can be an Israelite and not be Jewish. But as we're coming back, we're beginning to understand things. And we're beginning to understand God's way. And because we have an identity problem, we still have this identity problem, we still don't know who we are, we tend to have a problem of arrogance. Because when we come back, we start to tell the Jews that you don't know what you're talking about in regards to Sabbath. The Jews say the Sabbath begins when there's three stars. We say the Sabbath begins at sundown, right? And so we like to take and make fun of the Jews waiting on their three stars to close their Shabbat, even though they normally open their Shabbat before sundown. We think that we understand Torah better than the sages of old, who for 2,000 years have been studying this, yet for us, we're relatively new to it. For many of us, this Torah walk thing is pretty new because it hasn't been too long ago that we were eating pork and worshiping trees, bowing down to trees, putting presents under them. So we've had a period of arrogance, and this arrogance has caused problems between us and our Jewish brothers. But probably the worst part of what's happening today is that because of our attitudes toward our brothers, and I'm not talking about just Jewish brothers, I'm talking about our other Christian brothers who are coming into this walk as well, but having different views than us. But because of the arrogance that many of us in the Hebrew Roots movement have shown, we have inhibited our ability to fulfill the purpose for which God has called us at this time. And we have a very specific purpose, and Paul brings this out very well. For the past 14 months in our fellowship, we've been studying the book of Romans. And the book of Romans was mentioned this morning by Duane. And he read a passage in chapter 10, which is a very important passage. And I'm going to go into chapter 11 just a little bit. But, you know, if you're going to study the book of Romans, you've got to do it with more than simply your King James Version of the Bible and your Strong's Concordance. When we began to study the book, we got out our concordances I took and, our commentaries. I got out Expositor's Bible Commentary and a very popular Bible commentary, and we were studying from that, though we soon realized that they were probably as confused about the book of Romans as most everybody else when we saw that. But the one key to understanding the book of Romans, at least for me, was the Septuagint. Now, how many of you know or are familiar with the Septuagint? Okay, not enough of us, I can say that. The Septuagint is a very interesting book. The Septuagint is the Jewish translation of the Old Testament into Greek that was done 200 years before the Messiah was born. Now, why is that important for us? Well, there's a number of reasons. The first reason is that because we have the Septuagint, which is a translation of the Hebrew into Greek, we can now go into the New Testament and look at Greek words and find out what their meaning or their corresponding word would have been in the Old Testament. And that's really important if you're doing Bible study. The second thing why it's important is because it gives us the Greek understanding of many prophecies about the Messiah before the Messiah came on the scene. And so it gives us a view that's not tainted by the Jewish and Pharisaic traditions, which is important for us. We can see what they actually thought these prophecies meant. And the third point about the Septuagint is that it's the most quoted text in the New Testament. The writers of the New Testament did not quote out of the King James Bible. They didn't do it out of the Masoretic text. Many people think the Masoretic text was in existence during the time of the Messiah, but that's not true. The Masoretic text came on the scene about 700-800 AD. All they had was various texts that were collected of Hebrew, and they were very, very few and far between. But the most prevalent text during that day was the Septuagint. And so when you see a quote in the writings of the apostles, it'd be a good study tool to go back and see how that was quoted in the Septuagint. In fact, most of Paul's writings, when you look at them, will not say the same thing in our King James Bibles as what Paul said, but it will almost match word to word and it's out of the Septuagint. And that's really important. In fact, the Romans 10 verse that Duane mentioned this morning has a somewhat different meaning when you read it out of the Septuagint than it does out of the Masoretic text that we have today. So in our study of Romans, and it was quite intense. In fact, there was sometimes we would come and study for an hour and we wouldn't get through three verses. It took us a long time to get through the book of Romans, but I think it was very rewarding. But one of our findings was this, and that is that after the resurrection of the Messiah, God had begun a partial fulfillment of the prophecies of return. That God, at the death of Messiah, there were many non-Jewish Israelites who are beginning to return to the walk. And we see that in a number of places in the book of Acts, especially Acts 15. A number of places all over the book of Acts do we see the return of people from the lands. They weren't necessarily Jewish, but they were a people from the lands. They were the exiles. And it becomes pretty clear in the book of Romans. And another thing we found out was that the returning Israelites, those people, the exiles who were returning, were having problems fitting into the synagogue in Rome. And Paul was trying to deal with it. He was trying to figure out how to handle it. Of course, Paul, I'm sure by inspiration, knew how to deal with these people. But Paul also was trained in such a way that he could deal with these types of problems. The problem that they were facing in the first century is the same problems we're facing today. And if you're outside of the congregation and you're going to various conferences and stuff, you'll see it's very prevalent. You may not recognize it here, but you get beyond this, you'll see that it's a very big problem out there in the Hebraic, Messianic world, you might say. The world of people who are coming out of Christianity and turning to God's walk. And again, it's the resistance of the Jewish believers in accepting and welcoming in the non-Jewish believers into the synagogue, into the community of Israel. Well, you know, Yeshua had a little bit of insight into these things, and so he gave a little parable about this very thing, this unwillingness to accept your brother back. And this parable, we all know, is the parable of the prodigal son, where you had an older brother who had been following and walking in his father's ways, but then a younger son who had gone off and was eating with the pigs and all of that stuff. And then the younger brother repents and says, hey, I'd rather be in my father's house. At least there's food in my father's house. And so he comes back to his father's house, and what does he get when he comes back? He gets resistance from his older brother. This is a parable that I believe Yeshua gave specifically to the disciples so they would understand that you're going to have these feelings of resistance too toward those who are returning. And so you need to watch out for it. And we know one blaring example of that was with Peter. Peter was one of those who, when he's with the Jews, he acted like the Jews. When he's with the non-Jewish Israelites, he acted like a non-Jewish Israelite. But when the two came together, he was in a pickle, because he couldn't act both ways all the time. And so he was ridiculed greatly for being that way by Paul himself. Part of the problem in Rome was that of oral law, oral tradition. The Jews believed and taught that only Jews could become part of the people of God. And so if the returning Israelites were going to become part of the people of God, they had to convert to Judaism. And Paul said, oh no, that's not the case. You don't have to convert to Judaism, because these people were already Israelites. They don't have to convert to Judaism to be a part of the people of God. And I would submit that this was the biggest problem that we had in Rome at that time. But that's the problem that we're having today. Because there are people out there who are teaching that if you really, truly want to be a part of the people of God, you've got to convert to Judaism, and many people are. And for those of you who don't want to convert to Judaism, then you don't have to keep Torah, because Torah is only for the Jews. Now, where have we heard that before? Is this in any of our recent history? Yeah. It's in all of our recent history. And so But there's a new twist on it now, because we got people who are coming out of the churches who are wanting to become the people of God, walk like the people of God, and now they're being told by the Jews, you can't do that. Or you shouldn't do that. And actually, some of the arguments that were in the churches, when we told people, well, you know, I think I should keep the Sabbath, well, now the Messianic Jewish people, not all of them, some of them, are saying, well, you're wanting salvation by works. Because the Torah is only for the Jews, and you don't have to do that to gain salvation. And if you try to do that, that means you're trying to be a Jew, or you're trying to mimic the Jews. And as such, it's causing a lot of problems in the Messianic world. But there are other problems in Rome too, and I touched on that a little bit earlier. Another and probably equally distressing problem was that the non-Jewish Israelites who were returning were telling the Jews, you guys got it all wrong. You guys missed the Messiah. We didn't. You guys didn't understand the prophecies. We did. What's wrong with you guys? It's sort of like a young apprentice machinist. Fresh out of machinist school, just knows just a little bit about how to run a lathe, and he walks into a big machine shop and he starts telling all the seasoned master machinists, you guys don't know what you're doing. I was told in school how to do this right, and you're not doing it right. Even though it's been working for them for 30 years, you know, I'm here to tell you how it's supposed to be done. Well, that's what another problem that we found in Rome during the first century. And Paul, of course, was trying to deal with this. There was sort of an in-your-face attitude that was prevalent in that day amongst the non-Jewish, let's call them Christians, in regards to the Jews in the first century. Another similar problem, and it's sort of laid between the lines. You sort of have to understand the culture of the first century Jewish people to see this. Another problem is the disregard that the non-Jewish Israelites had for the Jewish traditions. Now, for those of you, in fact, we were talking about it during lunch today. How many of us understand the difference between clean and unclean meats? How many of us understand the difference between common and unclean meats? Well, you know, when Peter was given the vision of the blanket coming down with all the animals in it, God told Paul to don't call anything, any man, common or unclean. He didn't say, don't call any man unclean or unclean. He said, common or unclean. And he did that for a purpose, because these are two different Greek words that are used here. But the word that's used for common in the first century basically meant that it was clean food, but was not rabbinically kosher. For instance, you could have a nice lamb here that's all cooked up perfect and everything, and it could be set on the plate, on the table, and that lamb, if it had not been tithed on, was unclean. I mean, was called common, and thus couldn't be eaten. I'll give you a good example. Back in 1999, at our very first Feast of Tabernacles that Angie and I hosted, we were trying to work with all of the kosher eating people and the non-kosher eating. When I say kosher, I mean rabbinic kosher people. And so we went to great extent to take and prepare a table for 300 people so that we could all have a meal together, because the people who eat rabbinic kosher generally won't eat with people who don't eat rabbinic kosher. Okay? So we went to great lengths to have this table all set just perfect, and everything was, as far as we knew, rabbinic kosher. And it was going to be a great night. And everybody was filing in to find their seats, and we had the places marked kosher so that everybody would know that it's kosher. And lo and behold, this couple comes in and they look and they said, "We can't eat this." And we thought, why? Well, there was creamer on the table. Coffee creamer on the table. And the coffee creamer on the table made the whole table common. Okay? So these are the problems that we face in regards to the returning Jews. And so it was a mistake on our part. We didn't know that the coffee creamer was going to make the table unclean or unkosher. Common. And if we had, though, we would have eliminated the problem because we didn't want to offend anybody. And we weren't blatantly disregarding their traditions. We were trying to uphold their traditions. But in the first century, there was blatant disregard for the traditions of the Jewish people. And remember, the returning Israelites were coming not into the church. What were they coming into? They were coming into the synagogue. And who were the patrons of the synagogue? It's the Jews. So when the non-Jewish Israelites came in, they should have paid attention to the traditions of the Jews and tried to not offend them, but they didn't do so. And that caused problems. So anyway, Paul went ahead and in Romans chapter 11, he begins to try to straighten the problem out. And the way he goes about trying to straighten this problem out is by trying to show what was going on in that day and why God had called these non-Jewish Israelites into the land or into the walk, as well as why God was calling many Jews into the Messiah, to understand the Messiah, because there are myriads of Jews who understood about the Messiah in the first century. And so, let me make sure I'm not getting ahead of myself here. Yeah, I am. So before I go there, I'm going to go into this point here. What can we do to help our Jewish brothers as well as our non-Jewish believers who are turning the Messiah walk, to the Messianic walk? How can we get along in order to build the family of God? I've got 5 suggestions. I want to get into this before we get into that because it helps set this up. What could they have done to prevent the offense that happened? And what can we do to prevent the offense of those who are coming into this walk? I don't care if they're Jewish, non-Jewish, Christian, Buddhist, Mormon, whatever you want to, whatever. What can we do to keep those people from being offended so that they can, so their hearts can be turned to the Father's? What can we do? The first point I would say is that we need to stop putting people down. And this is something we all tend to do. Don't elevate our beliefs, our congregations, and ourselves above others. Don't think that our walk is better than your walk. And don't be in, don't start trying to, just don't think that way. Remember that God is calling that person back, and God's got them right where He wants them. And in regards to the Jewish people, we need to understand that they are God's people too. They are our brothers, more so than any other people on the face of the earth. The Jewish people are our brothers. We are going to have to someday walk hand in hand with the Jewish people because the prophecies say so. The prophecies say that He's going to call Israel and Judah together. And there's going to be a time when we're all going to be going up to Jerusalem together. During the time of King David, period of time called the Glory Days of Israel, the Feast of Tabernacles was the greatest of all festivals. And during those days, Israelites from the northern portion of Israel, the area around the Sea of Galilee and all up Mount Hermon, that whole area, people would begin to walk toward Jerusalem to observe the festivals. And so they would start up in the northern kingdoms, they'd up around Capernaum, those areas, and they would begin to make this trek down toward Jerusalem. But it's always called going up to Jerusalem, though. But they were making this trek down the highway towards Jerusalem. And who are the people who would begin the walk? Because of the geographic location, who would have been the first people to step forward and start taking this walk? It would be those from the northern tribes. It would be Ephraim. It would be those from Gad, those from Manasseh, those from all the tribes that were considered non-Jewish tribes at that time. And they would be gathering as they went, and more people would join in as they went further and further south, and to where eventually they got into the land of Judah. And who would then have to join in when they got down there? The Jews. Well, it's going to be the same thing for us as we start observing the festivals more and more, because we are the ones who are beginning to keep the festivals more and more. As time goes on, more and more Jews are going to be coming in and participating in the festivals as well. And we're going to have to accept them in as they begin to join us. We can't be putting them down. The second thing we can do is to capitalize on what each person or group has in common. And you think about, what all do we have in common? We all believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He is the God of Israel, right? Okay. We all have this one God belief, okay? I hope. We all subscribe to the teachings of the same book, the Bible. And even though the Jews, in many cases, won't accept the New Testament as Scripture, they sure quote from it a lot, and they sure refer to it a lot. So I would submit to you that the same book pertains to both groups. And for most of us, we all agree to the same name, though there may be different, we may pronounce it differently in different groups. I guess I'm a little bit lazy. I pronounce it Yahweh. Nevertheless, I think you all understand who I'm talking about when I say that. And I would submit that there are a number of Sabbath-keeping groups out there that pretty much believe everything that you guys believe. They may have a few differing views here and there, but they all pretty much believe the same thing. And so we've got to learn to capitalize what we have in common so that we can work together. John mentioned earlier today that we've got to come together as a group, because we can't get anything done if we're out there as lone rangers. And the more the various groups get together, the more power we have to influence, not force anybody, but to influence the way people think. Another thing that we need to do is to avoid drawing lines in the sand. We are really good at drawing lines in the sand. We say, if you don't say it this way, you can't be worshiping the same God. If you say, and I'm going to say it, Jesus, then you're worshiping a false Messiah. Okay? But is that true? No, it's not true at all. Everybody's on a different page. God's got everybody right where God wants them. We have to trust Him that that's the case. I'll give you a good example of a line in the sand that was drawn. Back a few years ago, I was part of a group that I was part of the Worldwide Church of God. And I remember a preacher getting up and giving a teaching, and he made the statement that if you don't believe that Jesus died and was resurrected exactly 72 hours later, you don't believe in the same Jesus I believe in. And that was pretty rough. Now, I wasn't bold enough back then, though my wife would probably say I was. But I wasn't bold enough to go up to a preacher and tell him, show me where the Bible says that I have to believe that in order to be called the people of God. Because it just ain't there. God never says you have to believe a certain time frame to be believing in the same Messiah. But yet we draw these lines in the sand and we say that has to be. But it's not. It's not there. But God has given us very clear lines in the sand. It's called His Torah. And if we do well to avoid crossing those lines in the sand, so let's try to limit the lines in the sand that we draw to be in the ones that God has drawn, and not try to add to the Bible what God has not put there. I mean, we go out there and we blame a lot of people, or we accuse a lot of people of adding to the Bible, and we have done so ourselves. Fourth thing that we can do is we can learn more about the culture of those who share similar beliefs. There again, I was part of the Worldwide Church of God. And when people found out I was part of Worldwide back years ago, that automatically discounted everything I had to say. Even though they believed 90% of everything I said, it discounted it simply because of where I came from. Many of you may have experienced that as well. People were scared of people from the Worldwide Church of God because they just didn't understand them. And in most cases, all they heard was rumors. But in many cases, it was just rumors. Now, there was problems there, just like there's problems in every group. But I would submit to you that at least back in the days that we were part of that group, you probably today believe pretty much everything they believed back then. I mean, I can remember when I was the only person in my school that didn't go and play my trumpet in the Christmas concert, or the only one who had to leave school for the Easter, Easter parties, Christmas parties. And I was in a school of 300 kids, and boy, it sure, you were a lone ranger when you had to leave. But now I would submit that you just go out and go to any school around nowadays and you'll find 10 to 15 kids, maybe 4 or 5% of the school population now. The kids are walking out on Christmas parties and stuff because they're starting to see these things. We need to learn a little bit about Judaism. Not that we want to convert to Judaism. I'm totally against converting to Judaism. 100% against converting to Judaism. But I think we ought to understand Judaism, because Judaism has an awful lot to offer as far as helping us to understand the Bible. Judaism is full of various traditions, such as their various prayers, their various festivals like Hanukkah and Purim. They have a lot of prayer books out there. And they have a lot of oral Torah, but I would submit to you that every one of our churches do the same thing. I mean, we got traditions in our church that we hold very dear. They're not biblical traditions. They're not bad traditions, but they're not biblical. But yet we take and hold them very dear. One of the traditions in Judaism, again, that is that I participate in, and that is the recitation of the Amidah prayer. I mentioned it earlier. I think the Amidah prayer is a great prayer because it helps you set up for your own personal prayers. But when I tell people in my former walk that I pray this Jewish prayer, they say, well, that's vain repetition. Well, you know, that thought comes from this verse, Matthew 6, verse 7. It says, and when you pray, do not use vain repetitions as the heathen do, for they think they will be heard by their many words. Do you ever look up the word heathen in that passage? The word is ethnos. You know how ethnos is translated in practically 90% of the times? Gentile. So Yeshua wasn't talking about the Jews having vain repetitions. It was talking about the Gentiles having vain repetitions. Did you ever think about that? Well, it's there. Just look it up. So it'd be good for us to learn a little bit about other cultures. Learning about other cultures helps us to see where they came from, why they do what they do, and may help us to understand better what Messiah was doing. And in the case of Judaism, we have to realize this above all other things. Yeshua is our Jewish Messiah. He's our Jewish Messiah. And then my last suggestion in these things is probably the most important suggestion, especially in regards to our relationship with our brother Judah. And that's found in Romans 11. Romans 11 is a mandate to non-Jewish Israel. That's us, folks. Non-Jewish Israel. If you read, let's turn all to Romans 11, verse 11. While you're turning there, I'll get a drink of water. Romans 11, verse 11. And it says, I say then, have they stumbled that they should fall? Certainly not. But through their fall, to provoke them to jealousy, salvation has come to the Gentiles. And as we study Romans, especially if you go to Romans 9:25, you'll see Paul's definition of Gentiles, and it is the exiles. I'll just tell you that. You can look it up yourself, but that's what it is. Paul defines Gentiles as the exiles in Romans 9:25. So in Romans 11, Paul says that through their fall, that is, the Jews' fall, to provoke them to jealousy, salvation has come to the non-Jewish Israelite. So what is that telling us? That's telling us that our mandate is to provoke Judah to jealousy. This is why we've been called at this time, is to provoke Judah to jealousy. Can we provoke Judah to jealousy by knocking their traditions, by telling them you killed the Messiah, criticizing their beliefs, accusing them of changing the law or adding to the law? I don't think so. I mean, when I was a young man, if I liked a girl and someone else liked that same girl, I didn't get jealous because he criticized me. I got jealous because he had something I wanted. Right? All right? We've got to get to the point where they want what we have. That is an understanding of our Jewish Messiah and the walk that our Jewish Messiah taught. And remember, what did the Jews claim as their very own? The Torah. And so the way that we can take and make Judah jealous is walking Torah better than the Jews. Walking Torah, walking the walk better than the Jews. If we just criticize them and tell them they're bad and all that stuff, all they're going to do is ignore us. And that's what they've been doing for the last 2,000 years. But they certainly can't ignore us if we're walking in Torah. And especially if we're doing it better than they. And I tell you what, the season of our joy, we have a young Jewish fellow who comes and he leads liturgy for us. You may know him. His name is Jeremiah Greenberg. How many of you got his siddur? Any of you got his siddur? Okay. He has a little Messianic Jewish siddur, prayer book. And Jeremiah tells me every year that he just loves coming to season of our joy and keeping the feast with us because we keep the feast better than the Jews. He said, you guys are better Jews than we are. And so this is what we've got to do. We've got to make them jealous for what we're doing. We've got to practice Torah better than they do. We've got to become Torah warriors in our diligence and our commitment to this walk. It can't be just a maybe I'll come to Sabbath service today or maybe not. Maybe I'll keep the festivals, maybe I won't. It's got to become a committed walk to this walk in order for us to make Judah jealous. You know, we're not making Judah jealous if we say that, well, we don't have to keep the festivals. They're saying, yeah, that's right, you don't have to. But you make them jealous by doing what they're doing and doing it better. This is, according to Paul, the reason why God is calling us back. It's right there, as clear as day, in Romans 11, verse 11. Well, I mentioned earlier this week, that this week's Torah portion is about Joseph revealing himself to his brothers. There's a story about the love and compassion Joseph had for his brothers, even his Jewish brother, Judah. It's also customary when you do a Torah study or a Torah reading that once that Torah portion, that parashah, is complete, you also go into another portion that's called the Haftarah. It's not half of a Torah. It's Haftarah. And it basically means the completion. Okay, the Haftarah portions were put together, from my understanding, they were put together during the time of the Babylonian captivity because the Babylonians wouldn't let them study Torah. So they found passages in the Bible that were similar to the Torah passage for that week, and then they would study that. They were allowed to study their Tanakh, just not study the Torah. And so the Haftarah portions are done every week. Well, it just so happens that this week's Haftarah portion is a very interesting passage. It was actually alluded to in a song that we sang today. You'll pick it up here in a second. Because this week's Haftarah portion is Ezekiel 37, verses 15 through 38. This is the two sticks passage of Ezekiel. It's the prophecy about the coming together of Israel and Judah. And let's just turn to it. Ezekiel 37, verses 15 through 19. It's important, so we'll just read it all, the whole passage here. It says, again, verse 15, again the word of Yahweh came to me saying, as for you, son of man, take a stick for yourself and write on it, for Judah and the children of Israel, his companions. Then take another stick and write on it, for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, for all the house of Israel, his companions. Then join them one to another for yourself into one stick. Take these two sticks and join them together. And they will become one in your hand. And when the children of your people speak to you saying, will you not show us what you mean by these? Say to them, thus says Yahweh Elohim, surely I will take the stick of Joseph, which is in the hand of Ephraim, and the tribes of Israel, his companions, and I will join them with it, with the stick of Judah, and make them one stick, and they will be one in my hand. We are to be joined together with Judah. And along the way, we're going to pick up a number of other people who are coming from various backgrounds and various beliefs that are going to want to join in with us. And are we going to allow them into the family? Are we going to help them turn the hearts? Are we going to be the Elijahs that are going to help turn their hearts to the fathers? Or are we going to put stumbling blocks in their way and thus bring catastrophe upon ourselves, as the prophecy of Malachi says? Let's let our hearts return to the dreams of the fathers, to the dreams of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And let's play a role in the restoration of the family of God. Shabbat shalom.